Are you ready, kids? Get your parents' permission, check your mailbox, and grab your shopping cart. It's time for the Adventures in Collecting podcast.
I'm Eric.
And I'm Dave.
Welcome to Adventures in collecting,
where we talk toy news, culture, and hauls,
along with our journeys as collectors. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Adventures in Collecting. Dave.
Hello.
Energy. I like the energy level.
I brought it up a little bit today.
Well, I mean, for good reason.
Yeah.
So as usual, we're not going to run through the rigmarole of normal things. We have no games to play today. We have no news to report. I am not going to bury the lead. We have a very special guest with us today. We have joining us, Dave, on the podcast. We have Steve Evans. He is the director of design and development at Marvel with Hasbro, and we are so excited, Steve, to welcome you to Adventures in Collecting.
It sounds like you're really excited. It almost sounds as excited as I'm going to be chatting to you guys. This is great. I've been listening and watching you and following you, and so it's finally good to meet you and have a good chat, Dave and Eric. So thank you for inviting me.
The pleasure is all ours.
Yes, very much so.
So before we dive into your history with toys and all of the interesting things that are going on at Hasbro, when we have a guest on, the first thing that we like to ask all of our guests is, what are they currently collecting now or excited about? So what is I know you post a lot of pictures on your Instagram about your very eclectic collection. So what are you excited about and collecting right now?
I do. Listen, the whole world is in this weird situation at the moment, and I've been working from home 8-9 months, so I've had to find a little outlet. So I've decided to kind of go back and collect my childhood. And I know we've all been doing it, and everyone listening is probably doing that right now. But I've always had my Star Wars collection, but I went back and I sat down and I started scribbling down all the things that really meant something to me as a kid that I could remember. And I had this long list, and then I started trawling, auction sites and, ringing up friends. And I've been collecting my childhood. And what that's been at the moment is, I've had great fun collecting Kenner's Indiana Jones, Adventures of Indiana Jones from 82. I need one more of the figures for that. I need the Monkey Man from the Cairo Streets playset. So if anyone knows of one, I'm in for it. So Indy, I've been looking back at Tron. I've been getting the old Tomy Tron ones. I've been tempted by the NECA ones, but I got to keep it pure, and I got to get the ones from 82 as well. So I'm doing well on that. And I'll tell you, the one I've really got my eye on and is incredibly expensive is the Ralph Bakshi Lord of the Rings figures from Knickerbocker. I've come so close to kind of buying it, but it's so expensive. But I know I've got a lead at the moment, and if that person is listening to this, then remember I'm still here. But there, so I'm just collecting weird eclectic stuff from the 70s and 80s. That are just part of my childhood. And I'm telling my mum, and my mum's sort of rolling her eyes, just like, "Will you ever grow up? What is your problem?" So that's what I'm getting. And you can see it on my on Mr. Stevie 18. You can see all those pictures of all that old weird eclectic stuff. But I'm loving it. I get great satisfaction from doing it, and it makes me feel warm and fuzzy. And I go down there every night usually and just have a quick scout, have a look at it, and you remember things. But so that's what I'm off. That's what I'm into at the moment. But it's changing every week.
Yeah, I have to say the thing that drew my attention was all of the ET merchandise, like the battery operated light up finger,
which I also had when I was a kid, and Kenner Indiana Jones too.
Yeah, that's I love that. I'd forgotten about that. I didn't have many as a kid. I think I had like the Cairo Swordsman. Interesting story, actually. I used to work with a girl, a lady in Hasbro when I was in London when I first started, Julie Wallace. And I remember her telling me her father-in-law was the actor that played the Cairo Swordsman. And so her son was, he was probably about three or four. I remember her telling him that his granddad was in Indiana Jones, and the kid didn't really understand it. And I'm like kind of starstruck. So that was a cool little story. So I remember having him, and I think I didn't even have Indy. I think I just had the bad guys. I may have had Sulla, but now I'm nearly got them all. So it's cool.
I think I only had Indy and the mechanic.
No, who's the main bad guy? The French, the other
Belloc.
You definitely
I had Belloc.
You definitely not only had, you have him. We found him when we were going through all the stuff in the basement. He ended up in one of your bags.
I feel like I had Tots too.
Yeah. Yeah, he was probably pretty common. He seems to be the cheapest one or the most reasonable one to get hold of. Like Belloc is difficult because he has that map. If depending on which one you've got, whether it's the regular one with his like slacks or whether it's the ceremonial one that was a mail away baggy. But I, you know, the one in his slacks, like you can get pretty reasonable, but I found one with a map because it's for me, and you know, I never keep things in the box. I always tear it out, even if I have a pack, and that's the only way I can get it. Not that I'm buying packaged Indiana Jones figures, you know, mint and then tearing it open. I'm not that stupid, but I have to have the little pieces. So finding the Belloc with the map, the little vinyl, it's like it's cut out of his kitchen flooring. Yeah, that little map is awesome. I was so pleased. So those little things please me. I'm easily pleased. It's the little things in my mind that the devil is in the detail.
So talking about all of these, these vintage toy lines and things from the past, let's go into your past. So how did you get into the toy industry?
Blimey, I hope your podcast's long because it's quite a long and windy road, but it's pretty interesting, I think. Anyway, so I was a Star Wars kid. I'll start when I was five, only 43 years ago. So when I was five, we went to America. We on one of our rare holidays, and I saw Star Wars in Man's Chinese Theater, actually, and sort of the place to see it. I don't remember it much, but I remember the sound, and I remember the X-Wings flying over. So I had this fascination with Star Wars, and then when Empire came out, I was older. So I was a Star Wars kid. I played with the figures up until I was probably about 13. Then I kind of discovered girls and sort of went away from that and gave all my figures away to kids, Andrew and Christopher, who I used to babysit for. And they burnt them and, you know, did the usual stuff, buried them in the garden and got rid of them. And then a few years later, in England, we call them boot sales. Over here, I think you call them flea markets or kind of flea markets. Is that right? Is that what you call it?
Yeah,
flea market. We call them car boot sales in England. And I saw these Star Wars figures, and me and my friend Simon, we said, "Oh, I remember those. They were cool." So we started buying them again for like 10 pence. You know, it's like nothing. And then I found that it was actually quite collectible. And I discovered Steve Sunsweet's From Screen to Collectible. Is that the right? That gold and black Darth Vader book that kind of spoke about it and showed it all. And me and my friend were hooked. So anyway, we collected and we ran around car boot sales and tried to get all the figures. And then I was studying graphic design at university, went to Brighton University, which is on the south coast of England, studying graphic design. And I bought and sold Star Wars figures to get me through that. That's how I made a little bit of extra money because I didn't get much money from grants. So I used to buy and sell. And Brighton was an incredible place. It had like two Star Wars shops, I have you know. Wow. Two places you could buy Star Wars and collectible toys. So I just kind of got into the culture then, and this was back in 92 by that time, 92, 93. And I came out of college and I got a job working for a company that made film posters and greetings cards and calendars and things like that. And so I was doing, you know, Independence Day posters and the Muppets and all this kind of stuff. And then I heard the news that Lucas George was making episode one, and I was very excited, and we tried to get the license for cards and things, and then a job came up at Hasbro in London, and I was like, okay, this is it. All right, I'm gonna get a job at Hasbro so I can get cheap or free episode one figures because I'll be working for the company that makes them, right? I've got to do this. So I went for the interview and I didn't get the job. And so I wrote them a letter back afterwards saying, look, I'm really interested. I think I can do stuff. I'd love another opportunity. So anyway, another job came up, which was for a concept designer. So that was a designer that would do new product ideas, packaging, graphics, marketing, anything. It was almost like a little bit of a rent-a-brain for a creative, rent-a-creative. Anyway, they called me back and said, hey, come back and have an interview. So I went back and I got the job in the end. So I started off there in 99. So it was literally the year episode one came out. And I've been at Hasbro ever since. So as I said, I was graphic design. So I started packaging. So I ran Action Man packaging, if you remember those listeners that remember the British Action Man and you know, the G.I. Joe equivalent. And then we moved into Atom, Alpha Teens on Machines in sort of like mid-90s. I did all the packaging. And we did a show with Disney and Jetix, if any of you remember Jetix, the cable station. And we did an Atom TV show. And I was really intrigued by this idea of creating characters and story and branding that was agnostic, that was like for show, for TV, for video games. And we did all that. So then I sort of moved away from packaging and into branding. And that's what I mean by branding. It's like helping to define what a brand means, the stories behind it, the characters, the graphic assets. So I used to make style guides. And so I worked on Action Man and Atom for a while. I then did some work on Monopoly, rebranding that. And then that's when Hasbro set up their Hub TV cable channel. And also was starting to work with people like Paramount and talking to Universal about, you know, bringing movies. So Transformers and Battleship and other things that didn't come off the ground. So I was doing that as well, helping to translate what a brand meant into different things. And that was the point where they said, well, if you want to do that, you've got to come to America. So I up sticks and my wife, Helen, and my three kids. Sam, but to be fair, I have two twin girls as well. So I had Sam and I have two twin girls, Bethany and Sophia. And we all went to America. I did some load of work on TV and movie. And then we sort of set up a proper studio. And then I moved on to doing a producing for app design. So I worked with Sesame Street, doing a lot of preschool app design. And then what did I do? Then I did some more branding and I helped set up some the packaging and branding departments with Hasbro. And then I got the call from the guy I was working with at Hasbro. He said, hey, would you like to, do you want to run Star Wars from a product point of view? And I remember saying to him, I said, you know, I know nothing about plastic, like zero. Like I couldn't tell you the difference between PVC and ABS and all that jazz. And he was like, yeah, I know. Well, you've got people that know all that. We just want someone that can kind of think about story and brand and meaning and just kind of tell stories and help construct a new idea for all these new movies they're making. This would obviously be the sequels. So how could I say no? I'd spent like 40 years nearly trying to get into Hasbro and massive lover of Star Wars. So I did that for five years or so. Then I did some work on CP and now I'm back onto Marvel. They brought me back into CP, sorry, as consumer products. So that I helped sort of do style guides for all our brands. So that's when I was working with Lenny a little bit when we were kicking off G.I. Joe and, you know, did some Transformers and Nerf and all the style guides that help other companies that aren't Hasbro make other products based on our franchise brands, Transformers, Pony, all that kind of stuff. But then I, you know, beginning of the year, they invited me back into Toy. And they said, how'd you like to do some superhero stuff? So I was like, yeah, why not? So that's my story. It's a very meandering tale, but it's 21 years of being at Hasbro. And sometimes I catch myself and say, wow, you've been there a long time. Is that too long? What else can you do? And then I very quickly answer myself and say, what am I talking about? I don't need to do anything else. I've never been bored ever. And I'm one that if I get bored, I move on very quickly. But, you know, I know this isn't a sort of a Hasbro commercial, but they're really good to me. They give you a lot of opportunity to try new things. They take chances. They took a chance on me with Star Wars, you know, didn't know anything about plastic. So I'm very grateful to them. And yeah, every day is new and exciting. You have some stressful days. But as I said at the beginning, when we were chatting before we went on air, it's like we do what we love. We're like, there's not much to complain about.
Well, listen, you took 20 plus years of experience and like distilled it down to 7 minutes. I would say that's pretty that was pretty concise. That was for a story that I was prepared to be meandering. You were really concise at that. So,
oh, well, thank you.
So cheers to that.
Cheers.
But yeah, I mean, Hasbro has been one of those companies, especially now during, you know, all of the pandemic and like the pandemic response to everything, the level of transparency coming from toy makers in general, but especially Hasbro with like the Fan First Friday events and, you know, these roundtable calls that are happening. It really is incredible the amount of access that you guys are giving to us, the collectors. And it's so appreciated. Like that, it. I hope you guys know how what effect you're having on the entire collecting base by doing this. So it is great what you guys are doing. It really is.
Yeah, and thank you for that. And I'm sure everyone from the Hasbro people that will hear this will thank you as well. And you know, I've been harping on for a long, long time about conversation, and anyone that's spoken to me or seen interviews, I often bring up that word, and I think it's very important. And conversation is always two way. You've got to speak and then listen. So the idea of, you know, Fan First Fridays, and I know we have the comments in that, and they whiz by at like a million miles an hour. You know, I know we find opportunities to do things like this, which is important. You know, it's, I want to be authentic. You know, these, we're a large corporation, we're a large company, and we make X amount of whatever dollars. But at the inside, we genuinely are toy fans. We're generally just designers and creatives and people that just love toys. And to be able to talk about things that we love is really important to us. It makes us feel good. It's job satisfaction, to be honest with you. So I'm very grateful to the PR team that they let us do more of this. And, you know, we have to be careful because, you know, our partners have, you know, incredible properties, you know, that are stories to be told in a particular way. So that is why, you know, you'll often find us, you know, being careful, but where we can, we'll talk about things and share the passion for toy collecting and movies and fandom in general. You know, we love talking about it.
Yeah, and that love kind of goes back far with us. Like we were just talking about the Indiana Jones toys. You know, my first ones were the Return of the Jedi too for Star Wars, and I know Eric grew up with those Power of the Force ones that you were talking about with the episode leading up to the episode ones. So, you know, you've worked with Star Wars. Now you're with Marvel. So you've worked with two of the hottest toy IPs out there rather recently. As popular as they are, how is working with them different?
I'll be honest, they're not that different. They're not that different. And you know, there are different stories, and there are a lot more, you know, Marvel put out a lot more movies than Lucasfilm traditionally do. That's different, you know, the amount of work or the amount of properties that we have to kind of think about and shift minds and think about different characters and different approaches and tones is different when we're creating, whether it's, you know, preschool, you know, core kid, which is like 6 to 9 year olds, or a fan business, which can be, you know, 12 to, how old are we? 48, 50, 60. But the fandom themselves aren't that different. They're very similar. You know, they have a lot of passion. There's a lot of heritage there. You know, they're both... they're both pretty old. I know Marvel's a little, you know, Marvel's older, but you know, there's heritage there. You know, there's the fans are very passionate, they're very knowledgeable, they have high expectations. You know, they're very vocal. They speak what they want and they complain and tell us when we're not doing something right, which is fine. You know, I do not mind that at all. I often use the phrase the good, bad, and the ugly. I said, tell me the good, the bad, and the ugly. I need it all because that's the only way that anyone's going to grow, and it's the only way we're going to do things better. So they're not that different. They wear t-shirts with their stuff on. They know all the they know all the names. They know more than I do, you know. And they're very loud and proud, and that's great. So I know that's a boring answer, but they're not that much different. But that's why, you know, when you think about collecting and fandom, it is all the same. And I was saying this the other day, you know, they're all the same. It's a basic human need. You know, the fact that we collect, you know, the idea of collecting and that can be collecting knowledge as well, you know, being a fan, is this need to feel in control. It's a need to feel a part of something that's bigger than you. It's a need for memories. It's a need for nostalgia. It's a need for emotions and stories. It's important. It's like, it's a way of being loved. And I know I'm getting very deep here, but I truly believe that, you know, that's why I do it. That's why I just told you, I'm collecting all these things from my childhood. Why? It's probably because I'm in a, you know, midlife crisis. I'm 48 and I want to remember those simpler times and those times where, you know, experiences were new and I can look at nearly all of my toys and talk about an experience or a memory that informed me, you know, that made me who I am, good and bad. And collecting and fandom, I think, does that. It satisfies a human need, which everyone needs. And, you know, some people don't collect, and well, they're not fans, they do other things. But for us in our DNA, all of us that love toys and fans, that's the way we express it.
Yeah, that's why, you know, it's one of the things that Dave and I talk about pretty frequently, you know, that kind of thinking of that, you know, the old, you know, stereotype of like, you know, like, oh, the nerds that, you know, collect toys and, you know, read comic books and stuff like that. And then you have like the jocks that are into sports and, you know, are sports fans and everything. And I love that, you know, as we've kind of progressed as a culture, those two things, there are so many people now, you know, us included, that like, we're huge soccer fans, we're huge baseball fans, we're huge hockey fans, but like I'm sitting currently surrounded by dozens of action figures at my desk, you know, like it is that culture of belonging. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, it's something that many of us as human nature, we crave to be a part of.
Yeah, exactly. And as I say, we're no different. You know, look at all those cliques that, you know, that you typically see in kind of like movies and TV shows, where you got the jocks, you got the nerds, you got the geeks, you got the kind of the super intelligent ones. I don't know what you call those, the speckies. It's all the same. It's just people satisfying their human need, but in a different way. And if you peel it away, it's all the same. I mean, it's a trope, you know, it's a story trope, that, but it's true. It absolutely is true. That's where tropes and cliches come from. Kind of truth.
Yep, they have to show up somewhere first, right?
Yeah.
So one of the things that that Hasbro has done to kind of do something extra special for you know the fan base is through the crowdfunding platform that you know you guys have developed, that the HasLab.
Yeah.
And you now have been a part of a few of those very successful campaigns in the Katana, the Jabba Sail Barge, the Sentinel, and the Razor Crest. With so many different IPs and brands underneath kind of that Hasbro umbrella, how do you guys determine who gets the next project? You know, like how is it like, do you just put a bunch of straws in a cup and then you got to like, how, like,
no, we have an arm wrestling match, but we were going to have arm wrestling, but unfortunately every HasLab would be a G.I. Joe one, because Lenny is just huge. He would just beat it. So we went, no, Lenny, we're not going to do arm wrestling. We're going to do something else. No, I don't think there is really a formula as such. I mean, every team, you know, we're all in separate teams. So we have a Marvel team, you know, G.I. Joe team and Star Wars team, Transformers, Pony, you know, all that. And we're always thinking about HasLab because it's such a great new for us, like really new way of bringing kind of dream items to fans that otherwise we'd find really difficult to give them, whether it's, you know, size, you know, in terms of putting that on a shelf in a store is really difficult, or it's like obscurity, you know, something kind of like, what's that? You know, but these dream items, these big dream items, it's really exciting. So everybody has ideas for them. Like I'm sure, I know there are lots and lots and lots and lots of ideas that we have. And there's probably even more and more ideas than the each individual, you know, property fans of the properties have. Like if I sat down with G.I. Joe fans and said, what do you want for HasLab? They'll have tons and tons and tons. So there really isn't. It's really about what's resonating with the fans, what we think makes sense from a storytelling point of view. And I mean by that is like what's the right thing to do at this point in time with our partners. You know, we're not just going to throw anything out there that doesn't make sense. But so, you know, we're still learning, we're still evolving, you know, and we've learned lots of new tricks. Like the barge was the first one and we cut our teeth on that, and that was a lot of fun. But that was a roller coaster ride, I'm not going to lie to you. It was like, are we going to make it, are we not? Oh goodness me, we've got to promote it. Oh, we didn't do unlocks. We gave away like Yak Face, but we didn't do unlocks. Okay, next time we do it, we've got to do unlocks. So we're still learning. And but there is friendly competition between teams, you know, like, you know, we did really well. Like the barge made it. You know, we had, what's the Transformers one? I'm sorry, Transformers.
Unicron.
Yeah. Thank you. You know, that made it. Sentinel did really well, and then the Razor Crest came in and kind of like blew us out of the water. So there's this little sort of like, yeah, well, we've got to come up with something that's going to beat that now. So that's fun, and that really only benefits the fans, to be honest with you, because everyone's trying to outdo each other. But I can't, there is no kind of real formula, and there's certainly no drawing of straws or arm wrestling Lenny, because I think I could take him.
Yeah, Lenny's a fellow New Jersey native, so like we understand. I wouldn't want to arm wrestle against another guy from New Jersey either.
And to be honest with you, he's the most heartfelt bloke I think I've ever worked with. That guy. We worked together when we kicked off the G.I. Joe Classified. We were working together on that for a little while before I kind of moved off toy, and I kind of hadn't kind of worked with him before, and I'd seen him and spoken to him a couple of times, and he's always a bit intimidating because he's massive. This guy. And it took about 10 minutes of actually sitting down with him and him just explaining to me kind of what he loved and what he was trying to do and what he believed in terms of toy and play and collecting. And I was like, you're super, super heartfelt. So I love him. I do love him. Love you, Lenny. Thank you.
Now, you mentioned the adding the unlocks to the future HasLab projects after the barge. So we saw something like the Sentinel that was so successful that it surpassed the planned unlocks, and I believe the Razor Crest did as well. How do you come up with additional ones to reward fan fervor?
Now, you've made some assumptions there that they weren't all planned. You said you got to remember, as I keep saying it time and time again, it's all about story, and story is about revealing and turning corners. So most of them. Nearly all of them, I don't know the Razor Crest that much. I wasn't involved in that. But as I understand it, most of it's all planned. Like we have loads and loads of unlocks designed, and we kind of select them, which one makes the most sense, which one makes sense when we reveal them in order. You know, you got to do highs and lows. You got to do things that people are going, oh my God. And then the next one's something different. Then we hit them again. So they're all pretty much planned from the very beginning.
Well, we fell for it. Hook, you got us hook, line, and sinker.
And you don't know quite where you're going to get to. So some of them are more planned than others. Let me tell you that. Let's say that then. Like we think, well, we might get there. So, you know, don't do as much work on that, getting that ready. But that was one thing that Barge taught us. It was like, no, we got to, the Barge stretched it out for 45 days because we didn't know whether we were going to make it. So there was lots of ups and downs. Are we going to make it? Are we not? But, you know, now that people understand that HasLab is A, there, and B, what it really is, and they understand, you know, when you get charged and all that kind of stuff, people are more inclined, or, you know, evidently they're up right for it, and there's better promotions and we're revealing it at better times. So we make our 6,000 or whatever it's going to be pretty quick. So then it's a question of like, okay, how do we keep engaging people and seeing, can we give them more? For the same price, I have, you know, it's like, you know, like if you make 6,000, we make 6,000. We don't, you know, all the unlocks are extras, which is a great thing. And I love giving those away.
So, you know, 2020 has been a very strange and unprecedented year for all of us. But one of the things that has been kind of really exciting, again, we mentioned the Fan First Fridays, but Dwight, Dan, and Ryan's bits on all of the Marvel reveals have been kind of like joy of joys this year. And one of the things that the Marvel team revealed, which was something that I think a lot of collectors A, never thought would happen, and B, were super excited for, was the Fox X-Men figures.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about how that actually happened, like how you were able to get that done this year.
Well, I wasn't on the team when that kind of got sorted out, so I didn't have sort of firsthand knowledge, but I did just connect with Dwight a little bit before this and said, Dwight, like, I'm going to guess that, you know, because, you know, Marvel Disney acquired Fox, that made that a lot easier, right? And he was like, well, yeah, yeah. And then he goes, you know what? He said, yeah, you know, I was so excited because Dwight is a huge Wolverine fan, Wolverine fan, and he's been wanting to do a Hugh Jackman figure for years. And so when that happened, he was like, "I wanted to do the Hugh Jackman figure." I rang up Jesse and said, "Hey, man, Fox is under your umbrella. Can we do this?" And it was like, "Yeah, of course we can." So that's kind of how it happened. It wasn't any sort of you know, Twilight deals or any kind of like smuggling going on. It was like, okay, Disney acquired Fox, and now that's easy to do. So we did it.
That's awesome. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, like, when you see, as a collector, right, when you see news about, you know, intellectual properties being acquired and kind of like things changing hands, I know, like, for me, as Star Wars makes up the lion's share of my collection, you know, when I'm watching a new episode of Mandalorian and, like, you know, I see Ming-Na Wen's character come up and I'm like, oh, and now I need a Fennec figure. You know, like, I just kind of I have always thought of things and, like, I wonder when I'm going to get that action figure, or, like, I wonder when they're going to make this one. It's great with all the MCU, you know, Marvel stuff. You're sitting there watching a movie and you're like, oh, Star-Lord's got a different length jacket on in this movie. I wonder if they're going to make another figure.
This is what I think about fans, you know, they're the same. Like, we can never satiate the need for different characters. And as, you know, as all the movies and, you know, Mandalorian's done an incredible job of kind of putting new characters out there that are really intriguing and, like, oh yeah, that's cool. So I do feel sorry for myself and for my team and for the other teams of kind of you know, super pop culture properties, just to try and keep up with demand. It's hard, but it's a good problem to have. I'd rather that than no one want anything.
Now, we talked about long time collecting many times throughout the episode thus far. I certainly go back a long time. So you see figures like, you know, Kenner Superpowers in the past and Secret Wars, yeah. Which are two things that I absolutely collected when I was a child. So we have something new that's kind of along those lines, which are the 3¾ Marvel Legends figures that are on their way out or that are still up for pre-order, I believe. So tell us a little bit about those and how those came to be.
So that was interesting. I think it was literally my first day on the Marvel team back at the beginning of the year. And I sat down with Dwight, and I'd known Dwight for a while before. And I said to him, I said, so what's new? What's cooking? I know you do Marvel Legends. I assume you're doing that, but, like, what's new? And he's like, well, we got these kind of weird, wacky kind of idea that, you know, we want to get a newer price point in, like a $10 price point. And, you know, retro's big and huge. And I just come from consumer products, and I've been doing style guides, and everything was retro. You know, it's all retro. So retro is the rise of retro. Retro's here because people need to feel comfortable and kind of nostalgic. And he said, well, we've got this idea of doing these kind of 3¾-inch, 5.7 points of articulation figures of, like, the sort of old school comic Marvel heroes. And I was like, ooh, that's cool. And then he goes, yeah, we're going to do them sort of like in Kenner style. And, you know, I haven't been a Kenner boy for, like, all my life. I was like, what do you mean, Kenner? They didn't do that. What? And he said, no. Well, it's just like, we figure we can make it in a Kenner style because, like, it's just, there is a look. There is a look to Kenner, and there is. It's, you know, it's quite blocky in terms of, it hasn't got a big triangular waist. It's not super exaggerated. It's quite sort of humanist looking, and the way they sculpted and the way it's put together. I chatted to lots of sculptors that worked on Kenner, and they explained to me why they did it, and, you know, breaks and kind of molds, mold patterns and engineering restrictions that created the Kenner look. And I was like, okay. So I kind of walked away and I was like, that's weird. And I thought about it, and I kind of, like, looked back and I realized, like, okay, let me think about this. Okay, so Kenner. So Kenner went into, what is it called? Superpowers. Superpowers, is that right? Yeah. Yeah, they went 4½-inch Superpowers in, like, 1984. And then Marvel, Mattel went into Secret Wars. That was 4½. So it would have to be before 1984, or Kenner would never do it 3¾-inch. Okay. So I went look back and I went, okay, so Star Wars, Empire, Jedi. Jedi was 83. Indy was 82, and they'd started doing knee joints and features. They had sprung arms. I said, but the Star Wars, they didn't do any features because they kept the continuity between Star Wars, Empire and Jedi. And, you know, I'm like, okay, so if we were doing 5-point articulated 3¾-inch figures and they were Kenner, they would have to be prior to 82. So around 80, 81 would make sense. Then I look back and I thought, okay, so Mego, they were doing some Marvel stuff in their Pocket Heroes. They were running into trouble around that time. They went out of business in 83. So theoretically, around that time, 81, 82, if Kenner got the license for Marvel, that would be how it looked. They would do, they would do 5-point articulated. They may or may not have done extra features and stuff, but that, okay. All right. As a Kenner purist, I was like, yeah, I think that could work. I like that. That's kind of cool. So it is absolutely the biggest what if story that there is. And so that really excites me. And then I saw the designs, you know, we were talking with Dwight and talking with Jesse and saying, okay, now what are the points of Kenner? You know, okay. So I spoke about the triangular of the torso, and there's certain the way the faces were decorated and kind of the way it's kind of constructed. So we kind of agreed that these could fit under the Kenner umbrella, and they'd be fresh and new and different, and we'd, you know, they'd appeal to hardcore fans that know the history as a sort of a weird what if, and they could also appeal to casual fans because they just look cool. They just look super wacky and very kind of on trend and retro. So we may get some new collectors in, because, you know, I talk about the big collector community, but that I want that to live on. You know, I don't want that to die with me. We need, you know, the fledglings. We need people like me 40 odd years ago that were kind of trying to scrape around car boot sales to find figures that they kind of loved or to buy and sell and get intrigued by this. So we need that next generation. And this is a way of doing it from a price point, from an aesthetic point of view. So I think it answers a lot of needs, and it kind of gives some different options, and it makes collecting a little less intimidating. You know, you go into Legends and like there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of figures, and it's like, that's intimidating for some people. So I'm always a fan of allowing people into collecting wherever we can. So that's basically Marvel Legends, you know, Retro 375. It's a what if story. It's a good price point. They're fun to look at. And selfishly, they fit perfectly in the memory shelf right next to the Star Wars figures, because they look like they're from the same people. So I can have my Star Wars, I can have my Indie, now I can have my Marvel. So,
it's fantastic. That scale though is at least for me, and I think probably mostly for you too, right, Dave? Like that is kind of like the scale, and that's coming from somebody who, you know, I have a lot of like the NECA 7-inch figures. I have a lot of the Diamond Select 7-inch figures. I have all of the 6-inch Ghostbusters, a ton of, you know, Marvel Legends and McFarlane figures and everything. But like, to me, the figures that speak to me most are those 3¾, 4-inch figures. So like, you know, the idea that you guys are continuing, you know, Hasbro's continuing, you know, the retro Star Wars line with the new Mandalorian figures in the style of like the 78 figures. I mean, like, oh my God, that is the coolest. Like because now you have, you know, you may have this generation gap, but you have these figures that are in the same scale that fit with each other, that like you can have the, you know, as a kid, just thinking with like a kid brain, you know, you can have the adventure of a lifetime with figures that make sense with each other. And anytime you put anything into that 3¾ scale, you immediately broaden your horizons there, because you have this legacy of figures that are in that scale where you can have the, you know, the adventure of a lifetime. So like, I love it. I absolutely love it.
And there are fans out there that, you know, came into kind of toys, you know, in the 90s, where we had more sort of 4.5-inch and 6-inch and stuff like that. So who knows what we're going to do in the future, but you know, nostalgia and retro tugs on our heartstrings, and I just think it's fun, just fun to kind of go back and play around with it a little bit. It's good fun.
Yeah, they remind me of, you know, what I played with when I was a kid. So, you know, the Star Wars figures, the Indiana Jones figures, you know, Superpowers, Secret Wars, G.I. Joe, like that was roughly all the same size. So for me, these are just like completely hitting on that nostalgia vibe.
And like you mentioned too, that with retro kind of being everywhere, like even in the Marvel Legends figures, like the retro packaging on, you know, like the 90s Toy Biz inspired packaging that's been coming out for like the Doctor Doom that came out this year, that whole Spider-Man wave, which is like wild, each figure wildly popular. You know, it is comforting to see those color palettes, to see them on pegs. Yeah, it's X-Men ones. it really does pull on your heartstrings.
Doesn't it? It's weird, isn't it? And listen, it's retro's everywhere, as you said. You know, it's in fashion. You know, it's even in automobiles. You can see the way they're being designed. And they're even re-releasing, like, I think it's the Ford Bronco or something. They've released, like,
retro
everywhere. It won't be around forever. You know, the trends will change, I am sure. Everything will change. So make the most of it. It's like, you know, it's just, if retro sings to you, then this is the time, you know, get involved and grab those things. Because, you know, who knows what's going to be popular in 5 years' time? I have no idea. I don't know. We'll see.
So we do have some questions from our Instagram followers, but we have one more for you before we jump into that.
Sure.
With your career spanning as long as it has, you know, through Hasbro, you have worked on countless projects. What was the most challenging project or specific item that you worked on, and why?
The whole time. Oh my goodness. I'm not going to talk about some of the ones that didn't go right in terms of like being really challenging, because I can't talk about those ones. But I do think, and I know I keep going back to the barge, but I think that is, if I could pick an item at this point in time that I can talk about, that sort of epitomized or the sort of pinnacle of my career in terms of effort, let's say that, like effort and love, and it was definitely the barge. I mean, that was, you know, the barge was the first one. Joni Navarji and myself, I wouldn't say we started HasLab, but like we were certainly proponents of like, we got to make this thing. How are we going to make it? And like the brilliant people at Hasbro kind of helped us, and, you know, finance and marketing and the digital team all kind of came together and said, all right, let's give it a go. We'll try it out. And we didn't know that it was going to work. You know, it's just like, it's a big kick. It's a big punt. And it was very different for us. You know, we hadn't done sort of crowdfunding type model before, so it's very, very, very different. And then, you know, we launched it at Toy Fair and we kind of announced it, and I remember people coming up to me just in tears and just kind of like hugging me, and I was like, wow, this really means something to a lot of people, because, you know, the barge has been spoken about for years and it's always a bit of a joke. It's like, oh, they'll never make the barge, it's just too big, it's ridiculous. And I was like, well, we better not fail. I hope this doesn't fail. Because we've just handed this massive olive branch to a very, you know, a very vocal part of the fandom. You know, these guys that are in Vintage Collection were like, this is great. This is incredible. And a long time coming. And let's make it. And, you know, the fans made up their own you know, websites and social sites and fan kits and posters, and they did it all themselves. And, you know, I tried here and there on my little Instagram, and we did it obviously on the Pulse, and we pushed it, and it sort of went off really quick, and then it sort of faltered and kind of slowed down, and we were like, oh my goodness. And just the pressure in hoping it would work and knowing there wasn't really a lot we could do about it. You know, it wasn't like, it's all on the fans. It's like, if you want to back it, you'll back it. I can't negotiate with people. We can't sort of like, it's not like trying to sell something to a retailer. But it pretty much followed the average trajectory of a funded project reasonably well. But it was very nerve-wracking. And I just remember when it passed that 6,000 number, it was just such a relief. And it was really pleased, because, you know, who knew what would happen if that didn't work. So, you know, I thank everybody that backed. I thank everyone that backed everything, you know, every HasLab item, but in particular the barge, because it was you lot that opened the door really for us to do new and cool stuff with HasLab. Doesn't work without the fans. Doesn't work without being backed and funded. And I know there are things that we need to deal with and that we need to solve, and we're still growing and still evolving. But the fact that we had two great successes recently with the Sentinel and the Razor Crest is very, very exciting. I'm not going to lie. I'm glad to be back in that area and arena, just to kind of be part of it, you know, albeit, you know, sort of somewhat in the background. You know, Dwight, Ryan and Dan are brilliant, brilliant ambassadors for Marvel, and they do a cracking job with everything. So it's really nice to kind of sit back a little bit and watch them. And I kind of tinker and tickle here and there where I needed to, but But I would definitely say that was probably my most challenging, stressful, and ultimately most rewarding project that I've worked on.
So I have to admit, so I live, you know, in a smaller house. You know, I have my wife and I now have, I have a 5-year-old now, and in a few weeks I will have a newborn.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, Dave will be an uncle times two.
I assume you have a barge then, because you've got your crib sorted out. Yeah. So that's great.
Well, so that was what I was going to say. So
I'll spoil your joke.
Yeah, no, it's all right. But back when the barge was up, I had actually made like I said, the lion's share of my collection is 3¾ inch Star Wars figures. That's my bread and butter. So I had actually made a deal with my wife, and I was like, listen, this barge is a lot of money. I have nowhere that we could possibly display it, but I cannot be the reason this thing doesn't get funded. So if it has not reached its goal by the end, I will be sitting there at 11:58, ready to click the back button. And I just remember feeling two things when I saw, you know, the following hashtag back the barge and everything. When I saw that it had passed, two things happened. I breathed a huge sigh of relief, because I was like, oh, thank God, all these people are going to get this. This is amazing. Like, huge win for the team and the community and everything. And then my second one was like, oh, but now this means I'm not going to get one, because I made a deal. But I did get the Razor Crest. That I was not missing that one.
So you didn't get the barge?
I didn't get a barge, no.
Oh.
I didn't. And, it's one of those things, like, it is easily one of my big regrets that I did not go in on that.
Dude, if I had another one, I'd give you one. You know me, I'm giving away barges and HasLab stuff.
I would never even dream to ask.
Well, I have one you can have that's signed by everybody on the team. No, you can't have that one.
No. No. That one, that is probably the most special barge there is, and it is right where it belongs. Display.
Oh, who knows? Maybe one day someone listening to this who's, I'm all about giving this holiday period. If you've got a spare one,
But then I'll also need a place to sleep. and relocate,
You'll be awake all the time just looking at it or feeding a newborn.
All right, so let's move into these. We have a couple of questions from our Instagram community. We put up a story. They threw some questions your way. Are you ready for a challenge?
Yeah, let's see how many sidesteps I can do. And I'll do my best, I promise. I
promise you won't have to have, like, proper dancing shoes on. Like, we'll
why have we done this figure? When's that figure coming out?
I promise you, there is none of that. All right. This one is a process question. So this one comes from at Rip Roaring.
Okay.
What is the timeline when it comes to the ideation of a figure to when it hits the shelves? And has this process gotten faster over time?
Yes, it has. It's had to. Traditionally, when I kind of landed in Star Wars back in like 94, 95, what am I talking about? 14, 15. It was about 18 months. Like, if someone said, hey, let's do this, then we would research it, get the assets, draw up input turns, submit it to Lucasfilm, or in this case, Marvel, they would say, yeah, that's a good idea, let's do that. And then we would get sculpting, and we would take X number of weeks to sculpt that, and then we would bring it back and check in. And is this good? Yeah, that's great. Okay, now deco, how are we going to put deco? What are the ops? How many have we got? What colors are they? Checking back till we got it approved, and then it would actually go into manufacturing, where we would then start making tools, these big hulking, steel tools that we'd have to make and produce, and then we'd get the factory line set up, and then we would do like some first shots in those kind of weird and wacky colored plastics that you see. And we'd check it, and then we'd have an engineering prototype, and we would check it, and then they would make others, and we'd move it down, then they would make it properly, and then we would do packaging, and then they would get it packed, and then it would be stored, and it would be put on a ship for 3 weeks to sail around the world, and then it would eventually get into distribution centers in all the different countries, and then guys with trucks would drive it to the store, put it on the shelf. So about 18 months originally, and we're now working a lot quicker, and sometimes we can get it down to like 12 months, but it's any time between there. And it is getting quicker because you know, we're digitally sculpting now. You know, we don't do it in wax anymore. So that's a lot easier to send around the world for people to check. So there's digital there. We're even working on digital deco now, where we're kind of painting things in ZBrush, you know, live. And so people can start seeing colors and things, and we're using those to render those out. And remember, we've been in pandemic lockdown for like a lot of time. So we've had, it's almost been a catalyst for us to improve digital use, digital processes. So the ability to kind of create a sculpt, paint it digitally, and then render it out for photography, because, you know, it's been difficult to take photographs of things because we haven't had physical things and we haven't had things shipping in. So this whole kind of last 8-9 months has been a real catalyst for doing things differently and faster. And we've also had to do it faster because, you know, the movie making process, although it's, you know, it's been in a little bit of a hiatus at the moment, is quicker, is faster. You know, we're seeing movies, we're seeing equally good production values in streaming shows. So the whole landscape is changing in terms of storytelling, and we've got to get quicker as well. So that's my answer. That wasn't even a sidestep. That was a head first dive in. So there you go. Hope that helped.
So the next one, it is from Creepy NJ at Creepy NJ, a friend of the show. So this one's more of a kind of, I'll say, wish list question. So fans are always requesting random obscure characters. If you could see one obscure Marvel character come to the Legends line, who would it be and why?
Now, the annoying thing is I'm going to say one. It's probably in the line because I just don't know the line that well yet. It's so many, many of them. I do have one, and I bet he's been done. Well, you guys will be able to probably tell me. I'm actually a big fan of Guardians of the Galaxy, the Jim Valentino comic from back in like 91, I think that kicked off. And so I had a little bit of a thing for, not a thing for Vance Astro, but a little bit, like, I just loved his costume. That sort of black and white, and it was sort of, he's kind of Captain America, but he's not, he's kind of cool. So I think someone from like Guardians of the Galaxy, maybe him, or like the original Yondu, I used to really like as well. I don't know if that's obscure, and I don't even know if we've done it before. So, Dwight, if you get to listen to this and you think, Steve, you idiot, we've done that already, then I apologize. But
I have good news for you.
What?
If you have $18, you can buy him right now from Walmart.
What? Who?
Vance Astro.
Really?
Yeah, he was part of the Titus Build-A-Figure line for the Guardians film. So there you go. You can have your wish list today.
Oh, is it the one in? So I'm going to try and kind of wriggle out of this because I just look sound stupid. But is it?
No, not at all.
Is it the one with his kind of skin tight cool outfit, or is it the one with the really weird bandana and the trench coat? Because if it's, I wanted the other one.
it's the skin tight metallic blue and white outfit with the cap shield.
That is the one I kind of wanted. Never mind. I'll say I wanted the bandana one with the trench coat that he had, which was weird.
But that's an older wave. So, you know, that's definitely a good pull. And plus, like, you know, one of the things that's so cool about the Marvel Legends wave, or Marvel Legends line, is that these characters have so many different iterations over the years. So many different artists have tackled them. You know, sometimes these characters are based off of like a cover variant that was done on one issue of a comic just because the aesthetic of that version is so good. So like maybe this is a character that that Dwight could revisit for you somewhere down the line.
Maybe you could.
All right. And the last question we have for you from our Instagram.
Sure.
This one comes from @DarthDonData. With the toy photography community growing at such a rapid pace, do you guys ever consider contracting work for promotional or box art?
We've spoken about that a lot, and I have an incredible respect for toy photographers. You know, there's kind of like a gaggle of ones that I kind of know pretty well, and they do incredible work. And we're always looking for new ways of profiling and highlighting their work. And we've done stuff with them, whether it's Hasbro Toy Pick, and, you know, we'll occasionally do, you know, I know Steven did a load of posters and things like that. So yeah, that's certainly not out of the question. That's not out of the question at all. And I accept and respect that it's moved on from a purely from a pure hobby to something that they're actually making a craft of, and they should make an income from it. They should make it a career. And so, yeah, I fully support that. But as I said, no plans that I know of at the moment to do that. But then I wouldn't tell you anyway if I knew.
Yeah, I mean, it's been, at least for us, in terms of engaging with the community and kind of growing awareness and everything, embracing toy photography has been one of not only the more fun aspects for us to try to participate in, like, learning from what these other, artists are doing with the figures and, the way that they're manipulating them. And, even in that, on Disney Plus, the Marvel 616 show, watching the profile on Mitchell Wu.
Yeah.
I mean, it is just what these guys do with these figures is just, it is unbelievable.
But who knows? I would never say never that we wouldn't kind of arrive at a packaging solution or something like that where we would use toy photographers. I mean, we have people that photograph toys, so I'm all for doing that and crediting it, but we shall see.
Okay, Steve, we have our last question of the evening. And this is one we ask everybody as the last question of the evening when they're a guest. So before you go, our last question is, what is your favorite and or strangest piece in your collection?
Which child do I like the best? Which child do I like the best? I should be asking you guys the same question when you have your new one arrives. I think actually I know the answer to this one. My strangest one is quite a recent one. So back in 1982, I've said we've been in that year many times tonight. E.T. came out. And I was living in England in a little town called Thorpe Lee Soken, very strange little town. And I lived in a house that was 13th century, really old. It's haunted as well, but that's another story. And I used to get £1.50 pocket money. I used to run up to Lipton's, which is like a supermarket grocery store at the top of the high street. I can see it now. And I used to go in the door, and on the left hand side there was all the crisps and chips, and they Nabisco used to make an E.T. biscuit cookie, a bit like an Oreo or a Bourbon to the Brits listening, where you would get two biscuits, and sandwiched between it would be a cola flavored cream, and these biscuits were colored green, brown, and orange, and they'd be different colors. So you'd get a pack of three, a green one, an orange one, and a brown one, with cola cream, and inside you got a free trading card, and there were 12 to collect. And I remember discovering this because it's a silvery packet. And I used to like, ooh, silver. I'm like a magpie. I was like, ooh, what's that? And it was the first collection I completed, those 12 cards. I spent so much money and ate so many of these blooming, disgusting, but delicious, cola cream, Oreo type biscuits. And so I finished the collection. And anyway, so I still have those cards. And years and years and years pass. And I go, and I can still smell the cola cream, even when I'm talking about it. I'm very kind of, I have a very attuned olfactory system, and I can smell it. And I was like, I'm going to look for the wrapper. I'm going to try and find a wrapper on eBay for that. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and blow me, it was probably about 4 or 5 weeks ago, maybe, I found an unopened packet of those biscuits at 38 years old. And I paid a ridiculous amount of money for them, but I got it sitting on my ET shelf, and they don't smell like cola, I can tell you that for nothing. But they're intact, they're a bit crumbly, and the silver's flaking off the packet, but that is probably one of the most emotional things I've ever opened, and kind of like had it in my hand, and the sound of the, it's crinkly and silvery, and I saw the biscuits and the color, and I just remember it took me straight back. It's a bit like in Ratatouille, when Ego eats the Ratatouille at the end, and he's like transported back to his childhood. That was one of those. So that's probably my strangest, because when I say, "Oh yeah, I got a packet of 38-year-old biscuits in my collection," so there's your answer.
That's amazing. Awesome. You posted the picture of it, and I saw it. I liked it. I think I might have even commented on it from our account. And I was going to bring it up when I brought up the light up finger at the top of the show. but I had a sinking suspicion.
Well, if I had a light up finger, that would probably be my strangest one, but that's a little bit too strange.
But one of the things that I have to say, you know, with the rise in popularity of the Great British Baking Show on Netflix and everything, I think that like the term biscuits and like, you know, all of the British colloquialisms for food items, I think they're kind of working their way into the American vernacular now.
I don't have to keep checking myself and kind of reiterating things in a different way. That's cool.
My 5-year-old calls everything stodgy now. So, I mean, it's just...
It's a little stodgy, Daddy.
Yeah, she'll tell me that things have soggy bottoms or that they're stodgy. So, you know, thank you, Paul Hollywood.
You're bringing her up well, I tell you. Makes my life easier not having to explain everything. Well, there are some colloquialisms that I do have to explain. People just look at me blankly when I'm saying certain things, but there we are.
Steve, well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us tonight. Before we let you go, please, if there's anything that you want to plug, I know you have an awesome giveaway going on right now. Let everybody know about that, where we can find you on Instagram.
Yeah, so I'm personally giving away one, either a Sentinel or a Razor Crest from HasLabs. It's my own, so I purchased it myself. It's not backed by Hasbro or anyone like that. I just, this time of year, I just like to kind of try and get people talking about the good things that other people are doing or the difficult times that other people are doing. So this is about finding someone that deserves our thanks or deserves our encouragement. And if you visit my Instagram page at Mr. Stevie 18, that's 18, and you can find out all about it. I'm kind of collecting nominations. You can't nominate yourself. That would be naughty. You can nominate other people that you feel deserve it. And I'll kind of personally choose 10 that I think are have meaning or sing to me, and then I'll randomize one of those people to win either a Sentinel or a Razor Crest. But the rules, the sort of how to do it is all on my Instagram site. Everywhere you look, you can't get away from it. But that gets drawn on the 24th of December, so you've got plenty of time. And there are some great stories there, and it's just very heartwarming to hear about people's troubles, but also how people are owning their troubles and how people are rising above their troubles, or people that, you know, selfishly just selflessly even that's a bad slip, selflessly kind of give their time and effort. And there are some incredible people that are being nominated, and it's just heartening that in this time of difficulty that there are people that still, there's good out there. There is good. I know sometimes it's hard to see with everything that's going on, but no, it is good. And if I can do a tiny little thing to give back to that, then I will.
Well, we will also do our part and share the information about that giveaway and continue to do so until the drawing. So we'll do what we can to help you out.
Cheers, man. I appreciate it.
And with that, Steve, thank you again for joining the show. You have a great night.
Thank you, Dave.
Yes, thank you, Steve.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Eric, listen, it's been great chatting, and best of luck with the birth of your new one. And, you know, I wish you all the best.
Thank you, dear listener, for hanging out with us today. Subscribe, rate, and review us wherever you listen, and then tell your friends to do it. Thanks also to Joe Azari, the golden voice behind our intro. Our music is Game Boy Horror by the Zombie Dandies. Find more about them both in our show notes.
Follow us on social media at AIC_podcast on Instagram and Twitter. Stop by and say hi, show us your toy hauls, and share your toy stories. Maybe we'll talk about it in a future episode.
Don't try this at home. Void where prohibited and some assembly required. Each sold separately, not a flying toy. Consult a physician if your toy run exceeds more than 4 hours.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.